The car from Carvana's here. Well, will you look at that? It's exactly what I ordered. Like, precisely. It would be crazy if there were any catches. But there aren't, right?
Right. Because that's how car buying should be. With Carvana, you get the car you want. Choose delivery or pickup and a week to love it or return it.
Buy your car today with
Carvana.
Delivery or pickup fees may apply. Limitations and exclusions may apply. See our 7-day return policy at Carvana.com.
Hello and welcome to the 19th Hole Golf Show. My name is Ryan Balaji. Thanks for joining us. You can email me, ryan@thegolfnewsnet.com. Check us out on our website, golfnewsnet.com, as well as on Yahoo Sports, sports.yahoo.com. Find us on the Devil Ball Golf blog. You can follow me personally on Twitter, at Ryan Balaji, or you can find Golf News Net on Facebook and Twitter, facebook.com, twitter.com/golfnewsnet. If you're a subscriber to this podcast through iTunes or another service, thanks so much for being a subscriber. Please check out golfnewsradio.com, which is the home to Golf News Net Radio, a 24/7 stream of golf talk that we think you'll really enjoy. I wanted to jump into this week's program on the topic of Patrick Reed and the war he has apparently declared against author Shane Ryan. A week ago, actually it wasn't even a week ago, just 3 days ago, Patrick Reed gave an interview to Golf Channel's Todd Lewis from Doral after the tournament at the WGC Cadillac Championship. And in that interview, he said he, and through his lawyers, would request Ryan, who's publishing a forthcoming book called Slaying the Tiger, it's about his year-long journey on the PGA Tour, and his publisher, which is under Random House Publishing, Ballantine Books, that they publish a retraction of an excerpt from the book that details, through anonymous sources, Reed's backstory, particularly his backstory at collegiately, when he played at the University of Georgia, and then eventually transferred to the Augusta State University, now called Georgia Regents University. And in Ryan's excerpt that he published on his website, TobaccoRoadBlues.com, at the end of January, he details through anonymous sources allegations that Reed had stolen $400 and a Scotty Cameron putter from a teammate at University of Georgia, that he was dismissed from the golf team for a pair of alcohol citations, including one that he and his family tried to hide from University of Georgia golf coach Chris Hack, and that teammates at Georgia, as well as Georgia Regents, accused Reed of trying to cheat, or actually cheating, during college qualifying tournaments on multiple occasions. And in Reed's interview, he said all of those things were untrue, and that he wanted to clear the air, and that he had obtained affidavits. He turned them affidavits from Hack as well as Josh Gregory, who was his coach at Augusta State. He then moved on to Southern Methodist and has since been ousted for some illegal recruiting violations. But he said he had obtained affidavits from these gentlemen saying that he had not been kicked off the team for cheating or for stealing in either place, and that those allegations were untrue, and he just wanted to clear the air and get that stuff retracted. The problem is, for Reed, is that the affidavit, so-called affidavit, at least from Chris Hack, has been made public courtesy of Stephanie Way at her wayunderpar.com website. Through a Georgia Open Records Act request, she obtained the statement that Hack provided to Reed's lawyers, a signed statement, a sworn statement, but not an affidavit. So there's kind of a legal gap there in terms of semantics between what would stand up in court versus what I'm telling you in a sworn statement. It wouldn't be legally considered evidence, I guess, in that sense, that strong of evidence. So in Hack's statement, he says two things. One, I was the University of Georgia and am the University of Georgia golf coach. And two, Patrick Reed was not kicked off of the team for allegations of cheating and or stealing, but rather for a pair of alcohol citations, and so that he had no knowledge of those accusations, the cheating and stealing ones, before Reed had left the team. So basically saying he got kicked off the team for alcohol violations, had nothing to do with these cheating and stealing allegations, which Reed touts as a victory because he's got a sworn statement from his coach saying he wasn't kicked off for cheating or stealing, or being alleged to have cheated or have stolen. Or stolen anything from teammates. So that is a victory in one sense if you're stupid, and it's not a victory in any other sense if you're intelligent, because what Hack said is essentially what Shane Ryan published in his excerpt that Reed was kicked off the team for two alcohol violations, one which he tried to hide from Hack along with his family, and that Hack, speaking then to Stephanie Way later, said that he wasn't aware of those allegations of the cheating or stealing until Reed had been dismissed from the program and left the program. So what Hack said was true, and what he signed was true. He wasn't making anything up, but it's a matter of semantics. So the allegations did exist, just Hack was unaware of them. And then subsequently, an assistant coach, while Reed was at UGA, spoke with Way and delivered his statement and said, those accusations did exist among players and some of the assistant coaches on the staff while Reed was at the program. So while it is true that Chris Hack says he had no awareness of those allegations and that's not why he dismissed Patrick Reed from the University of Georgia golf team, that doesn't mean they didn't exist and that doesn't mean that anyone wasn't aware of them. We haven't seen Josh Gregory's statement. Not sure how that's going to play out, whether we'll see it or where that evolves into. But it intrigues me greatly that Patrick Reed is trying so very hard to try to stamp out Shane Ryan, because this topic had basically gone away. Ryan publishes at the very end of January, and he brought it back, Reed did, in March, saying that he wanted to clear the air on this. And unfortunately, he's doing nothing but muddying it up. And it makes him look bad, especially when he's got such a semantically worded statement from Chris Hack that really does nothing to contradict what Shane Ryan has reported. And ultimately, the two stories align then. So Reed agrees he was kicked out for alcohol poisoning. That's what Ryan wrote. And Shane Ryan wrote. And then when you get into the remaining portions of the story, Hack mentions nothing about it other than he wasn't aware of the allegations while he was at the program. Doesn't mean he didn't know about them later. And then Stephanie Way goes out and says, well, this is all you're saying, so what's the next natural steps in this story? Gets them from folks who are involved with the program or are actively involved with the program. In Hack's case, he's still the coach. And now Reed looks even worse, in my opinion, at least. Now, of course, there's the natural reaction from people who don't like stories like this. Why are you dredging up something that's old about Patrick Reed? Why are you bringing skeletons out of the closet that had been properly put away? And I think the correct reaction to that is that Patrick Reed is the number 16 player in the world. He has 4 PGA Tour wins, and there are only four guys in the last 25 years to have that many wins by the age of 25. Woods, Garcia, McIlroy, and Reed. So Reed is in some pretty sweet company. So people want to know about his backstory. There's a general vagueness about it, about him, his relationship with his wife Justine, about his relationship with his family, the guy who was a match play genius at Augusta State, but why did he leave Georgia? There's been talk about that among his peers, although it never really gets out. This was going to get out there eventually, whether it was through Shane Ryan or through someone else. It didn't really seem all that important to me, but it was going to get out. And if you're not happy with journalists finding skeletons about somebody, I think if we all have skeletons, it's very evident. Everybody has skeletons, and they have things that they choose not to make public and things that they want to actively hide. However, in this case, this is a professional skeleton at this point. This is not a personal skeleton. This isn't, he's got a substance abuse problem. It isn't anything along those lines. However, that is also something that's tantamount to a professional problem, especially in the context of being a public figure. Reed is a public figure. He is one of the most talented players on earth, playing one of the games that has the utmost respect for honor and dignity and order. That's what makes the sport different than every other. And I know we talk about it all the time, but that's the cliche, and there's truth to it. So if we're expecting Reed to be an outstanding citizen, an upstanding guy, then these allegations that he stole and cheated when he was young and dumb, which wasn't all that long ago, he's 25, so that's 6 years ago, then I think it's something that people need to know about the guy. And instead of coming out and saying, I want a retraction, and I have crappily worded sworn statements that aren't legally permissible from coaches who agree with my backstory, except that it's not tantamount to my case, that makes you look bad. Instead of coming out doing that, what he simply could have done was said, yes, these incidents did happen, not quite as described if you want to dispute the details, but there were incidences in college where I was criminally reckless with my teammates' belongings, and I may or may not have broken the rules of golf unwittingly or on purpose. It doesn't even matter whether it's on purpose or not, but I broke the rules, and some teammates believe that I cheated. Acknowledge it, step forward, take responsibility for it, and then try to move on. It's way easier to say mea culpa than to say I didn't do it and then have to come back and say, well, yeah, I did do it and I'm really sorry about that. Sorry I tried to cover it up. Because now you're apologizing for two sets of problems. And Reed is creating the second set of problems for himself as we speak. Because Ryan's not backing down. He's got well-sourced, albeit anonymous, sources who are willing to tell this story. And I can pretty much assure you who those people are. They're people in the program at University of Georgia in Augusta State. There are only so many of those folks to play golf there. And many of them are PGA Tour pros now, particularly on the Georgia side. So I think it's very apparent who those sources are. So if you go, oh, well, it's anonymous sources. It could be like 5 of 30 people. It's really not that hard to figure out. So if you know that piece of it, it just makes sense to not alienate yourself further from your peers and potential fans and just say, I made a mistake and I would like to move on with your forgiveness. And that's the end of it. That's good. That's the way it should have gone. Reed screwed it up. Ultimately, this is going to lead down a further path for a couple of reasons. One, Reed is the number 16 player in the world. Second, Shane Ryan's not backing down. Third, Stephanie Way is good friends with Shane Ryan, so she's not going to back down. And a number of folks are friends with Shane Ryan who will happily advance the story on his behalf without him having to say a damn thing. And I could be one of those people. I don't know Shane extremely well, but I like his work. I think it's wonderful. And there's no reason to publish a book without well-sourced information. And he's an expert at knowing who to talk to, where to get information, and all that good stuff. He has a great ability to find information in the kind of vein that I really appreciate doing for you guys at Golf News Net and Yahoo Sports. So this isn't going away, and it's because Patrick Reed won't let it go away. And by keeping this in the news, it makes Ryan's book more attractive, and it makes it more likely that people will pick it up, and it makes it more likely that this story escapes the bounds of the golf community and becomes a sports story. And that is not what Patrick Reed wants. But we'll see where that goes. So let's turn to the actual golf of the week. Doral was terrible. There were a lot of things wrong with Doral. And the first piece of it was course setup. Doral is so long now, and it's always been a bomber's paradise, but it is especially so now to the point that you got to hit a 290 flush off the tee to have a chance to contend. If you look at the guys who were 1-2-3 at Doral in the end, and this is no coincidence, they're the three longest guys on the PGA Tour. And you could put Jimmy Walker or Rory McIlroy or a few other guys in that conversation of the longest hitters on the PGA Tour, Gary Woodland. But look at the guys who are playing really well and look at the guys who hit it really long. Those are the three guys who were right there at the end. And I think that tells you something about a golf course when only the longer hitters do really well. Now, Patrick Reed won last year. He is not a bomber by any stretch of the imagination. And Kevin Na had a nice week there and you know, really wasn't part of the conversation as a long hitter. But I think this year became very evident in its second year that Doral will continue to be a bomber's paradise. Donald Trump was not very happy with the setup. He thought it was too easy the first day, and then it got too hard. Players did not like it. Caddies did not like it. I think that some of the elements of Gil Hanse's design have started to become exposed as not so great. The 13th hole is a joke. It needs to completely be blown up in terms of the green complex. It just misses the mark too much for the kind of course that it is for the PGA Tour week to week. It might be great as a resort course with the green complex there, but it just fails as a PGA Tour par 3 in those kinds of conditions, how fast and firm they were. It's just not going to work. I think ultimately there's a lack of buzz around this tournament. And that lack of buzz is because despite this being a World Golf Championships event and the top 50 players in the world being invited to that tournament, it's kind of a big so what. It's Doral. It's not a special event. WGCs don't mean anything. They're not special designations anymore. It's just part of the name. Think about it. The only WGC that anyone really gives a crap about is the Match Play Championship. Other than that, can you name for me anyone that is fundamentally different than what you get at the Players or what you might get at Memorial or Arnold Palmer or Honda or any other tournament? You get a more diverse set of players from the world golf community, but that's about it. You get that to some extent at Doral because you have money winners from other tours in the International Federation of PGA Tours. So you get some of that into the top 50. At Bridgestone Invitational in August, you get a junk field because most of those players are just former team members of Team Europe, Team US, or Team International. So that's totally useless. Then you have the HSBC Champions, which invites a lot of high caliber players, but unfortunately the qualifying criteria is so convoluted that it really weighs down the field in the end, and the time change obviously doesn't do it very many favors in the United States. So the only WGC anyone gives a crap about is the 64-man tournament that is the Match Play, and it's no longer a straight bracket, it's groupings, so that's changed as well. Now, that's all done to be able to keep the top players around for longer than just one match, I get that, but and I think it'll reinvigorate the event. But I think that vein needs to be carried over to the other World Golf Championship events and create something different. I don't know what that ultimately is. Maybe it's a team event. Maybe it's some other format. I don't know. Maybe it's a full field event. Maybe you invite the top 100 in the world and see where that goes. And then you have a really deep field and make it very interesting. But there are just so many good tournaments now that they're all stroke play except for the Match Play, that there's no way to distinguish it. And you have to kind of feel bad for Donald Trump, and I can't believe I'm saying this, but he put a lot of money into this resort, put a lot of money into this property to build it back up from the luster it somewhat lost. And for whatever you think about Trump as a human being, and I do not think highly, he's done some tremendous things with the resort and the property. And he's basically getting a dud event, and the PGA Tour's raised ticket prices so high that the average Miami area person can't come to it, won't come to it. It's not the same kind of party atmosphere that it once was. If you go and look back at footage of the 2005 Ford Championship, I think it was 05, which was the best duel between Tiger Woods and Phil Mickelson they've ever put on with each other, I think if you go back and look at that, you'll see a completely different tournament. Scoring was easy. I'm not saying you're advocating for a 20-under par winning score, but you're advocating for birdies and a chance to get the crowd riled up. And you don't see that at the Cadillac Championship these last couple of years. That's a shame. I wish that wasn't the case. I'd like to see Doral recognized not only by the players as the unofficial start to the season, but also by the fans, and that it should be a big deal, and that it should mean a lot. And it just really, it doesn't. It lacks buzz, and it lacks character right now. And there's something that's got to be done to change that, whether it's scenery, whether it's format, whatever it is, but something needs to be done to change that. However, that all said, Dustin Johnson winning is a pretty big deal for golf. He now has won in 8 consecutive PGA Tour seasons. He hasn't won in 9 consecutive years, but he's won in 8 consecutive seasons, which is the longest active streak on the PGA Tour right now. It's a big deal. And he sets himself up to be in the conversation for Masters favorites, which I don't think anyone would otherwise put him into that conversation because he has a lousy track record there. His best finish is T13. He has a couple of top 30 finishes otherwise, but he's nothing really special at Augusta National. But he's in the conversation because he's played such great golf on difficult courses in coming back. He's got to finish T4 at Pebble Beach, which can be difficult. He finished P2 at Riviera, which is by no means an easy course. He got a bad draw at Honda, missed the cut, and then wins on a very difficult Doral golf course. So you have to wonder if Johnson has found the thing that will change his game around, will change his life around, from a guy who was a partier who may have had a drug problem to a dad who's 30 who's focused on getting the most out of the 5 good years that he probably has left before his body starts to break down and the violent swing that he uses with terrible, absolutely terrible mechanics starts to betray him. So I think he recognizes a window here, and I'm sure his team helped him recognize that there's a window here and that he's going to try to take advantage of it. Do I think he's going to win the Masters? Absolutely not. I'd be surprised if he finished top 15. However, I think this is an awakening in him that could mean he could play some great golf pretty much anywhere else this year. I think he would be a tremendous threat at both Chambers Bay and at the Old Course for the U.S. Open and the Open Championship. We know what he tried to do at Whistling Straits 5 years ago and had himself in contention for a playoff, but ultimately a grounding of his stroke, or grounding of his club at what should have been a waste bunker but wasn't, cost him an opportunity to a playoff and gave Martin Keimer his first major championship. So we know he's got a shining for that course. It'll be intriguing to see where he goes from here, because he's doing the right things. He's talking the talk. He's saying the right things, although he's still very sketchy on the details of his six-month leave of absence and doesn't want to talk about it, and the PGA Tour doesn't want to talk about it. I think that's an absolute crime. However, if he can block that distraction, that those peering eyes wanting to know what the heck he was doing for the last 6 months, then I think he has the potential to do some wonderful things. And I think because he's a little denser than us, he's going to be able to do that, focus on golf and keep the outside distractions away from him. However, I do want to segue from that topic of performance-enhancing drugs to comments made by John Daly on his SiriusXM show on Tuesday, where he called the PGA Tour's anti-doping program a big joke. That's his words, and sometimes mine. But what he talked about was that, and what he railed about, was the lack of what he perceived randomness in their testing, saying that he was expecting a test coming Friday for the fifth or sixth consecutive year that he's played in the Valspar Championship. Now, this policy's been around, this program's been around since 2008. It fired up just after Tiger Woods won his 14th and to date final major at the U.S. Open. And in that drug testing, there have only been just a couple of folks who have been publicly suspended under the policy. Doug Barron was suspended, and that, through a legal challenge, was taken. It was cut off short. A couple of other players have been suspended as well under the policy. However, there's been more scrutiny about transparency and how the program is run in the last couple of years, Johnson being a reason. Vijay Singh's lawsuit against the PGA Tour for its handling of his 2013 admission that he took deer antler spray, a reason. Another of the World Anti-Doping Agency coming out recently and suggesting the PGA Tour needs to do blood testing to truly have an up-to-snuff, up-to-date anti-doping program. As I've talked about several times in the past, it's only urine samples. There's no blood samples, but you need blood samples to catch HGH at all if you have any hope of getting it. And the PGA Tour refuses to do it, saying they believe that even a pinprick of blood might affect player performance, which I find heinous and just the dumbest suggestion in history. There are a lot of problems with this program, and the perception of randomness in testing certainly is one. But the biggest one is really transparency, because ultimately, Commissioner Tim Fincham is the judge, jury, and executioner of this program, and he has, under the guidance of the program's manual and rules, full authority, full bandwidth to decide whether players get suspended at all. If they have a positive drug test, they could be forced into rehabilitation in lieu of that. They can be forced to pay a fine. None of that can happen. All of that can happen in the case of drugs of abuse, so your cocaine, your meth, your marijuana, stuff like that. The PGA Tour doesn't even have to share disciplinary details with the public, because that could be considered damaging to the player's reputation in terms of sponsorships and things like that. So they choose not to do that, which means the PGA Tour could have very well told Dustin Johnson, stay away from us for 6 months, go do whatever you got to do. It could be rehab, it could be whatever, get your life back together. We won't call it a suspension, and you can deal with it as you'd like when you come back next year. That's basically how that works out. And the PGA Tour is right when they disputed Golf.com's report that it was a six-month suspension. Semantically, as we talked about earlier with Patrick Reed, they're right. It's not a suspension. They just told him to stay the hell away for 6 months, not that he was suspended, and there's a difference. And that lack of transparency, I think, throws a lot of people off. And yes, I do agree with Tim Pynchon. I do believe most fans really do not give a crap about drug testing. They don't really care about transparency. It is a media issue. However, it is an important media issue that ultimately affects how fans view the game. If they come to believe that the PGA Tour is running a phony drug testing program that really isn't doing much to protect the field and protect its competitors from potential doping players, then I think fans will suddenly become very interested in the topic matter and they'll want to know what in the world's going on. That's not going to happen anytime soon, so long as the Dustin Johnsons of the world try to, you know, sweep things under the rug and those kinds of things aren't acknowledged in public. But there's a potential turning point there, and I think the PGA Tour has to recognize it, and they're going to have to get it figured out quickly as we enter the true Olympic cycle, because players are going to be subjected to much more rigorous drug testing as a part of, and a regimen of drug testing as part of the Olympic drug testing movement. So it's going to get a whole lot more convoluted very soon, and that's going to make a really interesting time for golf as it tries to deal with how it wants to tackle potential performance-enhancing drug use, and if it does want to tackle it, does it want to do it at a level comparable to the international competition that it so desperately wants to be a part of. That'll do it for us this week on the show. Next week on the program, we'll find out if Tiger Woods is playing at Bay Hill or not. Maybe we'll find out if he's playing in the Masters. We'll get a better sense of his schedule going forward. We'll also have a chance to react to the Valspar Championship, the major event of the week in professional golf. You can email me, ryan@thegolfnewsnet.com. Please subscribe to the show if you don't already. You're listening on Golf News Net Radio, our 24/7 radio stream. And you can reach me on Twitter at Ryan Ballagy. But until next week, I'm Ryan Ballagy saying thanks for listening. And we'll see you next time on the 19th Hole Golf Show.
Time. It's always vanishing. The commute, the errands, the work functions, the meetings, selling your car. Unless you sell your car with Carvana. Get a real offer in minutes. Get it picked up from your door. Get paid on the spot. So fast, you'll wonder what the catch is. There isn't one. We just respect you and your time. Oh, you're still here? Move along now. Enjoy your day. Sell your car today. Carvana. Pickup fees may apply.